fall together into a neat stack. A stronger burst could tear a human to pieces in a second, as if some invisible demon had whirled through the room, but leave the organs arranged by increments of mass on a nearby table. Unfortunately, a few million megawatts of power were necessary for any such display. Lovely G was costly G. Only Imperial pleasure craft, a few microscopic industrial applications, and the most exotic of military weapons used lovely generation. As Zai sat speechless in the lovely black car, his heartbeat present in one temple, he was blind to the passing wonders of the capital. The car flew with an effortless grace between huge buildings, but he felt no inertia, no discomfort from the craft's banks or rolls. It was as if the world were turning below and the marvelous car motionless. Zai tried to do some hasty calculations in his head, estimating the total mass of the car himself, the corporal. It was staggering. The power consumed during this short ride would have been sufficient for the first 50 years of human industrialization. It wasn't the medal, the promotion, or even the guarantee of immortality, Zai realized. This moment was his true reward for his heroism, a ride on the heady surf of literal and absolute imperial power. Lieutenant Commander Zai was somewhat dazed when he reached the palace. His car lifted silently above the snarl of arriving limos and jumped the high diamond walls with a flourish, rolling over so that its transparent canopy filled with a breathtaking view of the Emperor's grounds. Of course, Zai experienced only a hint of vertigo, his inner ear in the precise and feather-light grip of lovely gravitons. There was no down or up in their embrace. Zai felt as if some giant deity had grasped the fountains and pleasure gardens to twirl them overhead for his amusement. The car descended, and he stepped from it filled with a regret suddenly remembered from childhood, the sad and foiled feeling that this carnival ride was over, that his feet were on solid, predictable ground again. "Lovely car," came the voice of Captain Marcus Fentu Masrui.
"Yes, sir,"
Zai answered with a mumble, still overwhelmed, barely managing to salute his old commander. The two watched silently as the vehicle was grasped by conventional transports, carried away to be cowled and caged like some exotic captive bird of prey.
"Welcome to the palace, Lieutenant Commander," Masrui said.
With an outstretched arm, he gently pulled Zai's eyes away from the car and toward the diamond edifice before them. Its shape was familiar to any of the Emperor's subjects, especially one Vaden-born, but from this close, it seemed monstrously distorted. Lawrence Zai was used to seeing the palace rendered in the scale of votive paintings, with the sun playing on its shiny surfaces. Now it was black and looming, darker than the starless night that it threatened to crowd from the sky.
"Power has an extraordinary glare, doesn't it?" Masrui observed.
The captain was looking up, but Zai still wondered whether he meant the palace or the gravity car.
"After my elevation," Masrui continued, "I took that ride, and it finally dawned on me why I'd spent all those years learning physics at Academy."
Zai smiled. Masrui was famous for his doggedness. He had failed the Academy's minimal physical science class for 3 years running, almost exhausting the dispensations that his genius in other areas had afforded him before finally obtaining a commission.
"Not the better to command my ship, of course. A ship is men and women, after all. AIs have done the math for millennia. But I needed to understand physics, if for no other reason than to understand fully that one imperial gesture."
Zai looked into his commanding officer's eyes. He wondered for a moment if the man, as usual, were being cynical. But the buoyant memory of riding in the craft convinced him that even Masrui might be sentimental about those minutes of flight. They walked up the broad stairs together. The sounds of the party flowed out between columns and heroic statues.
"Strange, sir, to have looked down on worlds and still be amazed by a mere flying machine." "It makes you realize, Zai, that you've never properly flown. We've been in aircraft and dropships, freefall and lifter belts, but the body always fights it at some level. Even the excitement comes from adrenaline, from some animal panic that things aren't right."
"But it's right in that car, sir, isn't it?" Zai said.
"Yes. Flight as effortless and natural as a bird's. Or a god's. Did we join the Navy for service and immortality, I wonder? Or for something more akin to that?"
The captain trailed off. A group of officers was approaching. Zai felt the subject disappear between him and his old friend, the words pulled back from the air and hidden somewhere like the conspiracies of mutineers. "The hero!" one of the officers said too loudly. She was Captain Rensa Fowler the Ninth, whom Zai, if the rumors were true, would soon displace as the youngest starship commander in the fleet. Zai saw Fowler's eyes sweep across his medaled chest and felt briefly naked again in the covering of clever ants. The others looked comfortable in their dress uniforms, the particulate nature of the garments completely disguised. Zai knew his ants were no more obvious than theirs. He determined not to think of the uniform again. "Only a humble servant of Empire," Masrui answered for him. Zai and Masrui shook hands with the men among the officers and touched closed fists with the women. Zai's head began to spin a bit with the surfeit of ritual greetings and realized how convenient the usual salute was. But this was a dress occasion. Forms had to be followed, and the pattern of bare wrists as gloved hands flexed and touched seemed to hold meaning, like animals flashing signals of bare-toothed dominance at each other. The glint of Zai's metal wrist caught starlight. They went into the palace hall together, and a crescendo of voices echoing from stone rose up around them like a sudden rain. Faces turned toward Zai as the group moved across the great black floor. The hero of Dantu, or as the gutter media called him, the broken man. He realized that the group of officers, arrayed casually around him, had done him a kindness, forming a shield between him and the stares of the crowd. He wondered if Masrui had planned their meeting on the steps. They moved slowly to nowhere in particular, his entourage hailing familiar faces and pulling them into the group, or fending off interlopers with a deflecting touch of greeting. One of them cadged a tray full of drinks and passed it round the group. Zai drifted along like a child in his parents' tow. The great hall was crowded. The lucent dress uniforms of Navy personnel were mixed with the absolute black of the political apparatus. There were civilians dressed in formal blood red or the white of the Senate, guild folk in colored patterns he couldn't begin to read. The high fluted columns that climbed to the vaulted ceiling channeled this mass of people into swirling eddies. After a few minutes of this promenade, Zai realized what would have been instantly obvious to an observer in the upper reaches of the hall. Everyone was walking in circles. Fowler's voice came from his side. "How's immortality, Lieutenant Commander?" Fowler, despite her meteoric early career, had not been elevated yet. "I hear it's not much different from the first 100 years, Zai answered. "Certainly the first week isn't." Fowler laughed. "Not missing the specter of death yet, are you? Well, I guess you saw enough of that on Dantu." A chill crawled up Zai's spine at the word. Of course, the planet that had seen his act of heroism, if that's what it could be called, was implicit everywhere tonight. But only Fowler would be graceless enough to mention its name. "Enough for a few centuries, I suppose," Zai answered. He felt movement on one flank. It was the ants reorganizing themselves for some vital bit of tailoring. They would pick this moment. Then Zai realized their purpose. A trickle of sweat had appeared under his real arm. Fowler's face was close in the pressing crowd. "Well, the Ricks are playing rough again, my connections on the frontier are saying. We may need heroes on that side of the Empire soon. They say you'll be promoted soon. Maybe get your own ship." Zai felt overheated. The sense of a nakedness had disappeared in the close air of the crowded room, as if the ants were linking ever more tightly, closing their ranks against Fowler's rudeness. Could they detect the woman's hostility and react to it as they did to light? Zai wondered. The little elements writhed in a column down and around Zai's side, carrying his suddenly prodigious sweat to the small of his back. "And the Spectre of Death always joins heroes at the front," Fowler added. "Perhaps you'll become acquainted again." The woman's false camaraderie was growing thinner by the word. Zai looked around for Masrui. Was he among friends here, really? He caught the eye of a young woman by the nearest column. She returned his glance with a smile and the slightest bow of her head. "She's quite pretty," Zai said, interrupting whatever Fowler was saying. That basic touchstone of desire had its desired effect, and Fowler immediately turned to follow the path of Zai's gaze. She turned back with an undisguised sneer. "I think you picked the wrong woman, Zai. She's as pink as they come, and perhaps a bit beyond your rank." Zai looked again and cursed his haste. Fowler was right. The sleeves of her white robe were hatched with the mark of a senator-elect. She seemed terribly young for that. Even in an age of cosmetic surgery, a certain gravitas was expected of members of the Senate.
Zai tried not to show his embarrassment. Pink, he said.
Anti-imperial, Fowler supplied, speaking slowly as though to a child. The opposite of grey. A brave defender of the living. That's Nara Oxum, the mad senator-elect from Vasthold. She's rejected elevation, for heaven's sake. By choice, she'll rot in the ground.
The mad senator, Zai murmured. He'd read that moniker in the same garbage media that had dubbed him the broken man. The young woman smiled again, and Zai realized he'd been staring. He raised his glass to her and looked sheepishly away. Of course, Zai knew what pink meant, but his native Vaden was as politically grey as any planet in the Empire. The dead were worshipped there, everyone claiming a risen ancestor as his or her personal intermediary with the Emperor. And of course, the Navy was grey from admirals to marines. Lieutenant Commander Zai wasn't sure if he'd met a pink in his entire life.
Mind you, I'm sure she'll accept the elevation when she's a bit closer to death, Fowler said. Just as long as she doesn't have an accident in the meantime. Wouldn't that be a pity, losing eternity for one's principles?
Or one's arrogance, Zai added, hoping Fowler would suspect whom he really meant. Perhaps she just needs a talking to. He pushed past Fowler, feeling the woman's skin against his own as their aunts briefly conjoined.
For heaven's sake, Zai, she's a senator,
Fowler hissed. Zai turned briefly toward his adversary and spoke calmly. And tonight I am a hero, he said. Senator-elect. Nara Oxen's eyes widened as Lieutenant Commander Laurent Zai pushed his way out and headed toward her. The purpose on his face was unmistakable. He gripped his champagne glass with all five fingers as if it were a club and his eyes locked hers. A group of officers had surrounded him since his arrival, cutting him off from the rest of the party in a display of protectiveness, and perhaps pride that one of theirs had been elevated so young. The handlers in Nara Oxum's secondary audio listed names and academy years as she moved an eye mouse across their faces. All were older than Zai. Senator-elect Oxum suspected that their claim on him was newly minted. The hero of Duntu would make a fine addition to their clique. For some reason, though, Zai had moved to extract himself from their attentions. The young lieutenant commander almost stumbled as he left them behind, as if pulling his feet from some invisible tangleweed on the marble floor. Nara Oxum fingered her apathy wristband ruefully. She would love to feel what was going on in Zai's mind, but the party was too crowded to dare a lower dosage. Oxum's entourage parted slightly to admit the young officer. Although the senator's empathic powers were currently suppressed, for most of her life she'd been able to compare facial expressions with what her extra sense told her. Even with the wristband at full strength, she was extraordinarily perceptive. When Lieutenant Commander's eye stood before her, she could see that he didn't know what to say. Vaden greeting, she subvocalized. Five appropriate salutations appeared in synesthesia, but in a flash of instinct, Nara ignored them all. You don't look very happy, Lieutenant Commander's eye. He glanced over his shoulder at his friends, turned back. I'm not used to crowds, ma'am, he said. Nara smiled at the honorific. He must be without a handler to have used ma'am instead of excellency. How did the Navy ever win wars, she wondered, when they couldn't manage a cocktail party? Stand here by the column, she said. She held her glass up to the light. There's a certain security in having one's back covered, don't you think, Lieutenant Commander?
Sound military thinking, Senator-elect, he answered, finally smiling back at her. So at least he knew her rank. But her politics?
These columns are stronger than they look, she said. Each is a single diamond, grown in an orbital carbon whiskater.
His eyes arched up, no doubt considering their mass. Making huge diamonds was easy in orbit, but getting an object that big down the gravity well safely, now that was a feat of engineering. Oxum held her glass of champagne up to the light.
Have you noticed, Lieutenant Commander, that the shape of the glasses matches the column's fluting?
He looked at his own glass.
No, Excellency, I hadn't.
Excellency, now. The officer's etiquette training was kicking in. Did that mean she had made him comfortable enough to remember his manners? Or was he feeling her rank? But I suppose I personify the analogy, he continued. I'd begun to feel rather like a bubble floating aimlessly. Thank you for offering a safe haven, Senator-elect. Out of the corner of one eye, Oxum had watched the rest of the officers in Zai's group. With a glance here, a hand on a shoulder there, they were spreading the news of Zai's defection. Now an older man of captain's rank was watching. Was he headed over to rescue the young lieutenant commander from the mad senator?
Captain Marcus Fentu Masrui, elevated, Oxum's handlers informed her. Non-political as far as we know.
Nara raised an eyebrow. Nothing human was non-political.
I'm not sure how much of a haven you found, Lieutenant Commander. She let her attention over Zai's shoulder become obvious. Your friends seem disturbed.
Zai glanced down at one of his shoulders, as if arresting a turn of his head back toward the officers. Then his eyes met hers again.
I'm not sure about that, ma'am.
They certainly look upset. Captain Masrui was still hovering nearby, unwilling to plunge in after Zai.
Oh, of that I'm positive, Zai said. But whether they are my friends or not...
He smiled, but was not entirely joking.
Success brings a certain amount of false friendship, Oxum said. At least, speaking from my own perspective, political success does.
No doubt, Senator. And, in a way, I suppose my own celebrity does have a political aspect to it.
Oxum narrowed her eyes.
She knew very little about Lawrence Zai, but her pre-party briefing had stated that he was in no way a political officer. He had never enjoyed assignment to staff or a procurement committee, nor did he publish military scholarship. He came from a long line of illustrious Navy men, but had never used his name to escape field duty. The Zais had all been warriors, at least on the male side. They joined the Navy, fought for the crown, and died. Then they took their well-earned immortality and disappeared into the grey enclaves of Vader.
What did the dead Zais do then?
Oxum wondered. Painted those dire black Vaden paintings, probably, went on endless pilgrimages, and learned appropriately dead languages to read the ancient books of the war sages in the original. A grim, infinite life.
Lawrence Zai's doubts were interesting, though. Here he was, about to be honored by his living god, and he worried that his elevation had been tainted by politics. Perhaps he wondered whether surviving an awful captivity was enough to warrant a medal.
I think the Emperor's commendation is justly deserved, Lieutenant Commander Zai, she said, after what you've been through.
No one has any idea what I've been through.
Oxum stopped short. Despite his rude words, the man's calm exterior hadn't changed in any way. He was simply stating a fact.
However painful, the man continued, having simply suffered for the Emperor is not enough to warrant all this.
A small sweep of his hand indicated the party, the palace, immortality.
Oxum nodded. In a way, Lawrence Zai was an accidental hero. He had been captured through no error of his own and imprisoned without any hope of escape. Finally, he had been rescued by the application of overwhelming force. In one sense, he had done nothing himself. But still, to have survived Dantu at all was extraordinary. The rest of the prisoners that the rescue had found were dead beyond even the symbiont.
Simply suffered, Zai had said. A ghastly understatement.
Lieutenant Commander, I didn't mean to suggest that I could understand your experience, she said. You've seen depths no one else has, but you did so in the Emperor's service.
He has to do something. Certain things must be recognized. Zai smiled sadly at her.
I was rather hoping to hear an argument from you, Senator. But perhaps you don't want to be in politic.
An argument? Because I'm pink?
Let me be in politic, then. The Imperial presence on Dantu is criminal. They've suffered for generations, and I'm not surprised that the most extreme Danti have become inhuman, which does not excuse torture. Nothing can. But some things are beyond being excused or explained, beyond logic or even blame. Things that start from simple power struggles, from politics, if you will, but ultimately dredge the depths of the human soul. Timeless, monstrous things.
The young man blinked, and Nara took a drink to slow her words.
Armed occupation seldom pays dividends for anyone, she said. But the Empire rewards who it can. You survived, Zai. So you should accept the Emperor's Medal, Elevation, and the Starship Command they'll no doubt give you. It's something.
Zai seemed surprised but not offended. He nodded his head slightly, his eyes narrowing as if thinking through her points. Was he mocking her? But sarcasm didn't seem to be in the man. Perhaps these were simply new ideas for him. His entire life had been spent among the greyest of the grey. Oxum wondered if he'd ever heard the Dantu liberation called an occupation before. or ever heard anyone seriously question the will of the risen emperor. His next question confirmed his naivete. "Senator, is it true you have rejected elevation?" "It's true. That's what secularists do. I've heard that they often rescind in the end, though. There's always the possibility of a deathbed conversion." Oxum shook her head. The persistence of this piece of propaganda was amazing. It showed how easily the truth was manipulated. It showed how threatened Greys were by the vow of death. "That's a story that the political apparatus likes to perpetuate," she said. "But of almost 500 secularist senators elected over the last 1,000 years, only 17 have accepted elevation in the end."
17 broke their vows?" he said.
For a moment, she nodded her head in triumph. Then she realized that Zai was not impressed. He seemed to think that few percent damningly high. For Grey Lawrence Zai, a vow was a vow. Damn him. "But to answer your question," she finished, "yes, I will die."
He reached out, placed one hand lightly on her arm. "Why?" he asked with genuine concern. "For politics?"
"No, for progress."
He shook his head in incomprehension. Nara Oxum sighed internally. She had debated this point in street encounters, in public houses, and the vast hall diet floor, on live media feeds with planetary audiences. She had written slogans and speeches and essays on this issue. And before her was Lawrence Zai, a man who had probably never experienced a real political debate in his entire life. It was too easy, in a way. But he had asked for it.
"Have you heard of the geocentric theory, Lieutenant Commander?"
"No, Excellency."
"On Earth Prime, a few centuries before spaceflight, it was widely believed that the sun went around the planet."
"They must have thought Earth Prime to be very massive," Zai said.
"In a way, yes. They thought the entire universe went around their world, on a daily basis, mind you. They had severe scaling problems."
"Indeed."
"Observational data mounted against the geocentric theory for a long time. New models were created, sun-centered models that were far more elegant and logical."
"I would think so. I can't imagine what the math for a planet-centric theory would have looked like."
"It was hideously complex and convoluted. Looking at it now, it's obviously a retrofit to uphold the superstitions of an earlier era. But something rather odd happened when the sun-centered theory, with all its elegance and clarity, was devised."
Zai waited, his champagne forgotten in his hand.
"Almost no one believed it," she said. "The new theory was debated for a while, gained a few supporters, but then it was suppressed and almost entirely dropped."
Zai narrowed his eyes in disbelief. "But eventually people must have realized, otherwise we wouldn't be standing here 2,000 light-years from Earth." Oxum shook her head.
"They didn't realize. Very few ever changed their minds. Those scientists who grew up with the old theory stuck to it overwhelmingly."
"But then how?"
"They died, Lieutenant Commander."
She drank the last of her champagne. The old argument still moved her, still made her mouth dry.
"Or rather, they did their descendants the favor of dying," she said. "They left their children the world, and thus the new ideas, the new shape of that world became real. But only through death."
Zai shook his head.
"But surely they would have eventually figured out, if the old ones lived forever, possessed all the wealth, controlled the military, and brooked no disagreement? We'd still be living there, stuck on that lonely fringe of Orion, thinking ourselves at the center of the universe. But the old ones, the ones who were wrong, died," she finished.
The man nodded slowly. "I'd always heard that you pinks were pro-death, but I'd thought that an exaggeration."
"It's no exaggeration. Death is a central evolutionary development. Death is change, death is progress, and immortality is a civilization-killing idea."
Zai smiled, his eyes roaming to take in the grandeur of the palace around them. "We don't seem to be a dead civilization yet.
1,700 years ago, the 80 worlds were the most advanced technological power in this arm," she said. "Now look at us. The Ricks, the Tungai, the Fastuns have all surpassed us."
Zai's eyes widened.
It was a fact seldom spoken aloud, even by secularists. But Lawrence Zai, a military man, must know that it was true. Every war grew more difficult as the risen empire continued to be outpaced by its neighbors. But 1,700 years ago, we were no empire, he argued. Merely a rabble of worlds like the Ricks, but far more divided. We were unstable, in competition amongst ourselves. We're stronger now, even with our technical disadvantages. And besides, we have the only technology truly worth having. We can beat death. The old enemy, Oxum quoted. That was what the political apparatus called it. The old enemy whom the risen emperor had dared and vanquished. Yes, we have beaten death, and yet the living still progress, Sai continued. We have the Senate, the markets. She smiled ruefully. But the weight of the dead is choking us. Slowly but surely, they accrue more wealth every year, more power, and a greater hold upon the minds of the living. Minds like mine? Sai asked. Oxum shrugged. I don't presume to know your mind, Lieutenant Commander. Despite what they say about my abilities. You think the Empire is dead already? He asked. No, not yet. But change will eventually come, and when it does, the Empire will snap like a bough strung with too many corpses. Lawrence Eye's mouth gaped. He was appalled at the image. Finally, she had managed to shock the man. Nara remembered when she had first used that simile in a speech on Vasthold. The audience had recoiled, empathically pushing back against her words, filling her throat with bile. But she had seen new thoughts swarming in to fill the spaces that horror made. The image was powerful enough to change minds. So you want us to go back to death? He asked. 200 years of natural life and then nothingness? Not necessarily, she explained. We just want to reduce the power of the dead, let them paint and sculpt, travel the 80 worlds on their pilgrimages, but not rule us. No emperor? He said. She nodded. Even with her new senatorial immunity, it was difficult to speak traitorous words aloud here in the Emperor's house. Even those born on secularist worlds had the conditioning of grey culture. The old stories, the children's rhymes were all about the old enemy and the man who had beaten it. Lawrence Zai was silent for a while. He acquired 2 more glasses of champagne for them from a passing tray and stood there, drinking with her. A few of his military clique remained close, but they didn't dare come unbidden into this conversation with a pink senator. Nara Oxum looked at the man. The Navy dress uniform with its coordinated horde of subunits certainly embodied the grossest aspects of Imperial power, the many made forcibly into one. But like much of the Imperial aesthetic, there was an undeniable elegance to the lock-stepped fit of myriad elements. Zai's body didn't have the squat look of most high-gravity worlders. He was tall and a bit thin, the arch of his back rather tempting. Let me ask you a question, she said to interrupt her own thoughts. Certainly. Do you find my words treasonous? By definition, no. You are a senator, you have immunity. But immunity aside, he frowned. If you weren't a senator, then by definition you would have just committed treason. Only by definition? Zai nodded. Yes, Senator, but perhaps not in spirit. After all, you are concerned with the welfare of the Empire in whatever form you imagine its future. Oxum smiled. Throughout the conversation, she had thought of Zai as unsophisticated, never having met a pink. Perhaps that was true, but how many actual greys had she herself spoken with honestly and openly? Perhaps her assumptions had been, in their own way, unsophisticated. Zai raised an eyebrow at her expression. I was just thinking. Perhaps minds can be changed, she offered. Without death to drive the process? Zai asked. She nodded. He took a deep breath and his eyes drifted away from her. For a moment, she thought he was using synesthesia. But then some glimmer of intuition told Oxum that he was looking deeper than second sight. Or perhaps, Laurent, Zai said, I am already dead. Something took hold of Nara. She felt an impossible moment of empathy, as if the drug had somehow failed. Far inside the man was a terror, a wound opened by the depth of evil he had seen. It cut like an arctic wind, like an old fear made undeniably physical. It was agony and hopelessness. And quite suddenly, she hated the Emperor for pinning a medal on this man, rewarding rather than healing him. How much of home have you seen, Laurent? She asked quietly. He shrugged. The capital, this palace, and soon I will meet the Emperor himself, more than most of the risen see in centuries of pilgrimage. Would you like to see the South Pole? He looked genuinely surprised. I didn't know it was inhabited. Hardly. Outside a few estates, the poles are arid, freezing, dead. But I am pro-death, as you know. My new house there is surrounded by a glorious wasteland. I intend to escape.